From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. It's Veterans Day weekend, so we think it's fitting to open with the remarkable story of a retired Army captain who nearly lost his life while serving in Afghanistan. Captain Sam Brown was responding to an ambush patrol when his Humvee rolled over a bomb. Captain Brown was set on fire for nearly a minute and resigned himself to death. His gunner was able to save him, but he suffered third-degree burns on 30% of his body.
Throughout the next few years and a series of surgeries, doctors were able to reconstruct sections of Captain Brown's damaged skin. He says he doesn't notice the scars anymore, but sometimes his friends point out how people who don't know him, maybe they're out in public or at a restaurant, maybe they react upon seeing the evidence of his burns on his face. In this clip, you'll hear Captain Brown discuss how his life changed after the bomb accident.
I had a kindergarten teacher whose husband was a firefighter, and he had been burned, enough to leave scarring on his face. It wasn't his entire face, but I remember as a 5-6-year-old kid, seeing him come to school one day and being frightened by that. And so then kind of growing up, and, we've all seen the PSA ads, the person who was, drinking and driving, and, then they got burned and, totally disfigured. And I remember just thinking, like, gosh, that's awful. That's an awful way to be and a way to, have to be. And so when that became my reality, it's scary. Not only are you dealing with the pain of the burns, but in my case, the literal loss of your face, which for so many of us is our identity, whether you like your face or not, I mean, that's your identity. And when you lose that, there's a deep emotional scar there. So it's tough, but you get through that.
The pictures I've seen of you pre-bomb attack, you look decently similar, do you not? Do you think?
I would say that, yeah, I mean, people can recognize me for sure, but that's also been what you see today in studio.
Yeah.
And where I've been, it's a night and day difference.
How do you react if someone, sort of sees you and reacts to the sight of what looks like burns?
So today I don't even recognize it. I mean, I'm just so oblivious to it. I'll be out with, friends, or, if I'm with, some new acquaintances or whatever, they're like, oh my gosh, Sam, did you see someone, that person over there looking at you? And I am literally oblivious to it. One of the things that did me a lot of good was when I was in therapy one day, in the burn military community, we have a great tradition of kind of going back to the burn unit and visiting new patients and trying to be an encouragement to them. And one guy came in, and he came in with his wife, and he had about a 2-year-old son with him. And he came in to just encourage us, like, hey guys, y'all are going to make it through this and you'll be okay. I'm laying on a table that's, about knee height, and my face is kind of up, and the therapist is working with me, and this kid kind of wanders over to the table. And he's standing about a foot away from me. He's looking me dead in the eyes. And then he turns and he looks at his dad and he says, hey, daddy, look, there's another daddy. And that just broke my heart, but in a really great way. I mean, it kind of shattered like that iron mask that I wanted to wear of the fear of what my face was, and just let me know that out of the purity of a 2-year-old's mouth comes this recognition that I'm not some sort of monster, but to him, I looked like another daddy.
What an amazing story. Just an amazing story. In a profile in GQ, I don't know if they're quoting you or referring to sort of a long-held quote that people who suffer burn trauma have, that, that the world would see them as either unloved or a monster, et cetera. And I'm heartened to hear that maybe that dissipates over time.
I can't speak for what other people see that are strangers. I can tell you that my wife tells me very genuinely, she says, Sam, I am attracted to who you are today. And I wouldn't want to be married to, the Sam pre-burn. And I've got other friends that I think genuinely tell me, they say, Sam, we don't see your scars anymore. You're Sam to us.
Next, a story of a small Midwestern city that could be the story of many cities in America. Janesville, Wisconsin was once a bustling working class community, home to the nation's oldest GM plant, a lot like Rochester during Kodak's heyday. Well, in 2008, when Janesville's GM plant shut its doors, more than 10% of the population lost their jobs. And that led to a domino effect, with related plants and businesses closing, resulting in more job losses and Janesville employees forced to make a fresh start somewhere else.
Amy Goldstein is a longtime journalist at The Washington Post, and she spent more than 5 years getting to know the people of Janesville. She shares their struggles in her new book, Janesville, An American Story. In this clip, she talks about what happened to a 35-year-old woman named Christy Beyer, who lost her job. She used to work at Lear, a GM subcontractor that made car seats, and that plant also closed its doors. As you'll hear from Goldstein, Beyer's story ends in tragedy.
Well, one of the things that I was interested broadly before I talk about what happened to Christy, as I began to get to know people in Janesville, was given the same economic trauma that all these people, thousands of people, went through, who turned out well and who turned out poorly, or in this case, tragically, and what accounted for who was able to recover and who wasn't. And in Christy's case, she had gone back to school with another Lear employee. They both, when you were saying they a moment ago, she and her friend, whose name was Barb Vaughn, both did very well in school and got these jobs, which were extremely desirable jobs, which hundreds of people were applying. $16.47 at the time was very good wages. They weren't GM wages, but they were good wages and good state benefits. So Barb starts working at the local jail as a guard, and after some months decides that she really is very uncomfortable in that environment, and she leaves and tries to find something else to do. Barb stays, and a whole set of unfortunate Christy stays,
thank you.
And a whole series of unfortunate events happen, including her starting an affair with somebody who had recently gotten out of the jail himself, an inmate. And she ends up taking a fatal overdose at a time when she's under investigation by her bosses and fears that she could be fired. And I've spent a lot of time talking with her mother, who's just, you know, heartbroken to this day that her daughter is no longer alive at her own hand. And her mother's belief, I mean, everybody sees things from their own perspective. I mean, that's sort of the point of the story. But her mother's belief is that if Christy had been able to stay at the seat-making plant, she would be alive to this day. I mean, there's no way of knowing. And some people lost their jobs and turned out fine, and some people lost their jobs and turned out dead. And I was interested in understanding the full spectrum of what happened to people after all this work went away. And as you mentioned a moment ago, one thing that happened both in Janesville and nationally is that during this very bad economic period, suicides went up.
Now let's turn to a Rochester native, actually a graduate of Pittsford-Bendon, who went to work for Condoleezza Rice in 2007. Todd Moss served as Assistant Deputy Secretary of State for African Affairs, and these days he writes thrillers. And he's just released his fourth novel. This one's called The Shadow List.
Moss talked to us about his new book, and he also discussed his views on what's happening inside the State Department now with the Trump administration. He did not hold back on his opinions. Let's listen.
So don't think you'd find very many people inside the State Department that have confidence that what's going on now is going to make it better. There's been a real deterioration of morale, a real deterioration of capabilities. We're seeing an absolute flood of high-quality people leaving. And what that leaves are a lot of either lower-level people in charge or real vacuums at the top. And that means that we are not well prepared in the face of international crises.
Did you like the selection of Rex Tillerson?
You know, I was agnostic at the time. I thought maybe there's a chance here that somebody who's run a huge organization, ExxonMobil is a massive corporation, could bring some corporate expertise to a bureaucracy that needed some fixing. But I've actually been exceedingly disappointed with what I've seen so far. We haven't seen either inside the building good leadership, and particularly we have not seen him able to present a coherent vision for the United States and the world. In fact, if anything, we're only seeing U.S. leadership around the world deteriorate, and he bears some responsibility for that.
When it comes to what your position was under Condoleezza Rice, is that position filled right now?
There is a career person in that place now, which is, you know, in one sense, that's fine, but you still need senior officials that have the ear of the secretary and the, you know, the stamp of the president to make important decisions.
I've always wondered how people like you feel in working in, whether it's for state or various parts of government, when, you know, you're somebody, you did all the hard work. I mean, you did Model UN. A little callback for you, George Papadopoulos fans. But, you know, Todd is, when you were Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, I don't think you were selected for that role because you were a big donor or sort of a friend, et cetera. I mean, you worked your career into that role, whereas a lot of diplomatic positions, I won't say a lot, I don't want to speak out of school, I don't know, but from my perception, a lot of diplomatic positions get handed to people who are maybe not as deeply qualified. And I'm not saying Rex Tillerson's in that role, but you could probably look at a lot of different posts and they get filled by that. How does that impact people like you when you see people who don't have expertise popped into those positions, sometimes over your head, and making calls on things?
You know, I think in most of the real decision-making capabilities, traditionally, and this is for both parties, they've put very strong people with lots of experience in positions. You know, the head of the bureau that deals with Asia is typically somebody who's got 30 years of experience working with Asian allies and understands those issues deeply. The place where you get very clearly political appointees, you know, the golfing buddy of the president, is the appointment of ambassadorships, particularly to Europe. And that, you know, actually the State Department has a pretty good system where for every Oklahoma car dealer owner that was on the president's election campaign that's now president of and now ambassador to Belgium, there's a deputy who's a very senior level career person who actually does most of the day-to-day work. So I think that the system can handle the politics, but what we're seeing here is something completely different. Yes, President Trump is putting his buddies into some ambassadorships, but most of those are still vacant. And the key decision-making positions, the people that you want in the chair when all hell breaks loose and the United States needs to respond, a lot of those positions are just empty. And that, I think, is frankly very, very dangerous.
We're going to close with a little music this week and a great idea. Our colleague Scott Regan plays music with the band, and he heard a song title that he loved. That title was Don't Go Drinking on an Empty Heart. Scott thought every songwriter should have a song with that title, and that gave him an idea. What if all of Rochester wrote the same song?
Not the same song, of course, but what if every year songwriters were given a song title and they had to create a song to go with it? This is the third year for If All Rochester Wrote the Same Song. The song title this year is How Did We Get Here? 24 musicians will perform their versions.
We heard several performances in studio. Here is the great Scott Regan of WRUR Open Tunings. He's performing Don't Go Drinking on an Empty Heart. You'll hear him with Steve Piper and Sarah Long Hendershot.
Billy got his gun.
That's it.
Mary brought the flask. Now they're on the run. Never stopped to ask. Was it just for fun? One never, never thought.
That's
they
it. Yes,
never
I
thought
it.
Twice. Should have held it all together. It's falling all apart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Billy found his girl with Mary's only love. Now they left this world with the angels up above. They should have thought it through the 40 final round. And the whiskey came unglued and the bodies hit the ground. Should have held it all together. It's falling all apart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking. Don't go drinking. Don't go drinking. It's just not smart thinking with your heart. From the edge of town, we watched them drive away. Two people half unwound in a beat-up Chevrolet. Could hear that engine moan till it was almost out of sight, like some faraway trombone in the quiet of the night. Should have held it all together. It's falling all apart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking. Don't go drinking. Don't go drinking. It's just not smart thinking with your heart. That's the last we ever heard. Years just slipped away. Then someone got a word that just the other day, this young guy came to town tattooed with a crest, with a rose and crown, these words across his chest. Bright red letters, read before you start. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart.
That's great. Yeah. That was wonderful.
Don't remember. Beautiful.
Yeah.
And look at that. Look at the harmonies there. We had a little three-parter going there.
You know, what's really fun is this one was a murder ballad, and we've had a few of those, and Steve did a country tune. But the diversity in the styles of music is one of the really, really fun things about the show.
Did you say murder ballad?
Yes.
Is that a genre?
Well, absolutely.
I mean, I know murder ballads. I could think of it. I didn't think of it as an actual category.
Well, Nick Cave, I believe, has an album entitled Murder Ballads. Do you know Nick Cave? He's an Australian.
I thought you said Nick Cage. I was not that interested.
No. Yeah. Nick Cave.
Nick Cave.
C-A-V-E, yeah. Okay, and he has an album of murder ballads. It's a fine old tradition.
Well, that was fun. That was beautiful little harmony, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Regan, thank you.
Billy got his gun.
That's it.
Mary brought the flask. Now they're on the run. Never stopped to ask, was it just for fun? One never, never thought, never thought twice. Should have held it all together. It's falling all apart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Billy found his girl with Mary's only love. Now they left this world with the angels up above. They should have thought it through before the final round. And the whiskey came unglued and the bodies hit the ground. Should have held it all together. It's falling all apart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking. Don't go drinking. Don't go drinking. It's just not smart thinking with your heart. From the edge of town, we watched them drive away. Two people half unwound in a beat-up Chevrolet. Could hear that engine moan till it was almost out of sight, like some faraway trombone in the quiet of the night. Should have held it all together. It's falling all apart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking. Don't go drinking. Don't go drinking. It's just not smart thinking with your heart. Ass the last we ever heard. Years just slipped away. Then someone got a word that just the other day. This young guy came to town, tattooed with a crest, with a rose and crown, these words across his chest. Bright red letters, read before you start. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart. Don't go drinking on an empty heart.
That's great. Yeah. That was wonderful.
Don't remember. Beautiful.
Yeah.
And look at that. Look at the harmonies there. We had a little three-parter going there.
You know, what's really fun is this one was a murder ballad, and we've had a few of those, and Steve did a country tune. But the diversity in the styles of music is one of the really, really fun things about the show.
Did you say murder ballad?
Yes.
Is that a genre?
Absolutely.
I mean, I know murder ballads. I could think of it. I didn't think of it as an actual category.
Well, Nick Cave, I believe, has an album entitled Murder Ballads. Do you know Nick Cave? He's an Australian.
I thought you said Nick Cage. I was not that interested.
No. Yeah. Nick Cave.
Nick Cave.
C-A-V-E, yeah. Okay, And he has an album of murder ballads. It's a fine old tradition.
Well, that was fun. That was beautiful little harmony, too. Thank you. Scott Regan, thank you. And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every afternoon, every weekday afternoon, from 12 to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. For Megan Mack, I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice weekend. We're right back with you Monday on member-supported public radio.